On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I am honored to be sitting across from a man who is one of the preeminent figures in 21st century filmmaking, the writer-director Holly Dreamer. His films, I'll tell you, his newest film, the film that's available now, his newest film, of course, is Teza, which we'll talk about at some point too, but he made a film that deals with PTSD, basically the co-option of African-American culture by white culture, homelessness, income inequality, a film that was made in 1982, and that film is Ashes and Embers. First of all, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, and especially seeing you after you helped me publicize Sankofa a long time ago.
It's still a brilliant film. It was basically the year the film came out, Sankofa. But this film, Ashes and Embers, to me, weirdly always felt like almost like the black version of Chekhov. I mean, it starts off with sort of flashbacks, and basically the whole film is told in flashbacks. It's the story of a young man who comes to Los Angeles, who is so thrilled about becoming part of the movie business. He's singing the Rufus song Hollywood, mm-hmm. as he's being driven down Sunset Boulevard, and he and his friend are pulled over, which triggers all these associations and memories for him. And you can't see these guys being pulled over and not think about Ferguson or New York or any place in America where these things are still happening. In fact, that idea, these guys, in fact, they just, one of the guys says, and they're getting pulled over, we're just a couple black guys being pulled over by the LAPD. If something happened to us, it'd just be two black people pulled over. Just to have dreams deferred in that way. Did you have any sense when you made this film in 1982 that we'd still be talking about these kinds of things in the 21st century?
I did. You know why? Because everything postponed will be the most divisive aspect of all human beings from coming. What prevents people from coming together actually is all this postponed racial issues, police brutality especially, put from the patrol system of the plantation system. It mortgaged the new generation. So for me, I knew, because I had some special vision, but I just felt the fact these fundamental issues were hidden. The fact they were not processed to exorcise them in the cultural sphere especially, they're going to continue to haunt this United States of America. In my view, to me, there's two issues that when I raised my kids, there's two issues I made sure they understood. One is the Native American issue in America. Every time they ate breakfast, that's what I remind them, that there is a spirit of Native Americans in the ground. They are now having their cereal. And then the African American question, because here is a whole history that the African race brought into this very hostile location. And in the historical chapter, it made its own historical process. It circumvents to empower white supremacist story angle. In hijacking that, you create a violent society. Every little kid, the minute you tell black kids in this world or colored kids or Chicanos that they have nothing to offer in this planet but be sidekicks to white principality, which is the cultural diet, you create a very violent legacy and you pass it from generation to generation. It's not going to go away.
It's funny because I was telling you before we sat down, you did a film before this Bush Mama, which I guess is the 40th anniversary of that film this year. And that film also dealt with a veteran who was coming home to what he thought was to be celebrated for his sacrifice. Instead, he had his whole future taken away from him. And Sankofa, for me, that's kind of a trilogy because it's about a woman of color, a model who suddenly finds herself dealing with slavery. And these three films are all about basically the usurpation of basically black cultural imperials, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, at all events of war, African Americans give America a chance to say, okay, I'll go to war to prove that I too am American. And then they return to be completely sidelined. And their history is untold. So many died in park benches from Richmond to Louisiana. I've come across, this is where I'm telling you, I wish people would know. I was informed these stories by realities that came right into my face and said, you know, to me, tell my story. So my whole, I think what I did is just integrated all these flying objects that came confronting me from African Americans who were displaced, not only by white America, but by the black bourgeoisie itself. The black bourgeoisie itself often makes a deal and it deals to transform its own survival. But it doesn't promise to live up to the inherent debt that black folks have for the history of resistance in America. And for me, the minute you defy that, it's going to be more painful penalty to pay that is passed from generation to generation. For me, would have been so simpler to allow, African Americans tell their own story, unadulterated or unintervened, even however toxic it is, it should have been exorcised. The more it wasn't allowed to be exorcised, it's contained. And when every time it explodes, it's ugly and violent. And I think when in storytelling, a lot of people think it's just entertainment, et cetera, but in storytelling, you continue to empower people. White people's trust fund to begin in any business, to go into any business, is the white supremacist cultural nutrition that gives them this, any idea I could put in place. From Facebook to anything, a white kid could say, today I will turn the sky into bread. They can finance that. African Americans with ideas, with inventions, it's a history of discardment that this country has to answer by. So filmmakers, what do we have? We have these stories that are in the margin of the official narrative that wants to live by pacifying everybody, in the end, victimizing the future children of America, both black and white kids.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the gifted, talented filmmaker who I think deserves the attention he's going to be getting here today, and more so, he's highly driven. His film we're talking about, which is from 1982, is Ashes and Embers. It's now available, or about to be available, on Netflix. Talk a little bit about where this story came from, because almost every film you've made, from your documentaries to this film, is about displacement, about basically having your future torn away from you. And you're talking a little bit about where that came from, but the idea of dramatizing this, I mean, not just making a position paper, but actually finding the drama in that idea of having our place in the culture torn away. What made you think there was something that could be dramatized and not just turned into, you know, a tract or a preachment?
Well, initially, you know, in the way African American history is disfigured and slavery itself, having come from Africa, I would be lying to you if I had this perspective that I'm getting. It is the respect and humble schooling myself at the foot of elder black folks I have met from Chicago to Florida, to South Carolina. When I was doing 1978, a film called Wilmington 10 USA 10,000, it's about, you know, the Wilmington 10 case. But I didn't go for the 10 case to prove it like Nightline or some 60 Minute. I went to the parents. I said, I want to know who raised them. Who raised them? Because often black people are orphaned by the official literature and cinema. They're orphaned. They don't come from nowhere. When you orphan a people, you leave them open for abuse. And so I said, okay, the elders in black people's life are important. Their wrinkles a story. And in fact, at the same time, I'm developing the script of Ashes and Embers. And I'm meeting these old ladies that I collapsed into one black woman. And these are women who have the history of resistance, wanting to pass to a kid that has gone to New York to be a ballet dancer. And I said, okay, whoa, Vietnam would be the most displacing factor. Even that came from the fact that when I went to the Goodman School of Drama, there was a brother called Big Ben. and he was demonized because he came back from the war. I didn't know about the war. I just came from Africa. I'm just trying to like get into the dream. And here he is. All teachers are bothered by him. And I joined to demonize this guy. And then later I discovered he came back from Vietnam. And I said, there's some drama here. This brother, completely out of guilt even, of the fact I betrayed him, not openly but even silently, for not understanding who he was, joining the chorus of the people who demonized him, the guilt remained in me. Then there was an African-American actor who plays the part in the film, who was the best actor, white or black, at the Goodman School of Drama. And some white Hollywood kids will tell you, when they were in that school, when John Anderson, the brother who played Ashes and Embers, was doing a scene, the whole school turns to come to see it. He was the best actor. They send him to Vietnam. He comes back. He becomes Ben. And I meet him in L.A. And I said, what is going on here? And I collapsed the two characters to write it. And then the issue was now for him to play it. And I was scared because he would flip now and then into this rage. And so I had, I don't know if you know the brother, Carl Anderson, who played in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, Carl Anderson, absolutely.
He was
sure.
slated to play the part.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but then I said, I don't want an actor to play it. I want this risky guy to play it. And he took it. He literally transformed the part because he came back. He came back like Big Ben. He himself joined to demonize with the white theater group there as somebody crazy, when in fact the fact he came back from Vietnam was a story for us. So here's again, I am like trying to be a student or trying to be a filmmaker, and then I'm hijacked by certain realities that I felt challenged my mercenary professional idea of cinema making. I said, no, there's stories that are beyond my ego, stories that are trying to come into me. And of course, let me just tell you, when Sankofa opened, there was an elderly African-American woman who was, every time we were evicted from a theater, she would be on her phone directing the audience. So I was supposed to meet her one time in the hallway in Manhattan. And I meet her, and she comes towards me crying. I'm telling you, my brother. She's like in tears covered. She comes, she hugs me, and she says to me, leans to my ear, and she said, she's on cane. She says, don't you ever forget it. Don't let it go to your head. You're a vessel. You're nothing but a vessel. And she just left. And for me, I'll tell you this. If my imperfect films affect people, it's the fact that this experience has, you know, they have humbled me. There was a girl I was dating in Richmond, Virginia. Her mother, her grandmother, was this sister with a gun trying to defend her home, even in the 1980s. And every time we drove away from her to go to Howard to school, I'd be like zooming back. My brain would zoom back to stay with her because we'd leave this only lonely African-American woman in a house she built, she worked, her husband dead, and the young offsprings are thinking of Hollywood, are thinking of New York, and the most earned land by these people was neglected. So I did a whole research on the land loss of black people. So the script was really worked a lot. I went to Atlanta, interviewed a lot of farmers. It's because a lot of black farmers were losing lands in a speed of light for many historical circumstances. And so the film is trying to do all this thing, and it's a very imperfect film, but I'm, you know, thank you for noticing all those things. But they're really a collage of these things that came to me. All I did was streamline them in this dramatic narrative to share it with people.
You know, it's fascinating. We're talking about cultural usurpation. If you look up this film on Wikipedia, just to show this what I'm talking about, they put the wrong actor John Anderson in. They put a white actor named John Anderson.
This brother, I'm looking for him. He came here. All the white actors who worshipped him became like stars. One is even in every mafia movie. He played Don Quixote. I was his Sancho. He's a big Hollywood guy. John Anderson, he worshipped him. And John was black, can't come, and he came to Hollywood. He's somewhere in Hollywood, either homeless or working in a magazine store looking for him. We lost touch of each other.
Wow, because there's one of my favorite scenes in any of your movies is a scene in the last third of the film where Randolph is leaping in a park, and he's disturbed by another veteran who says, this is my park bench. And that idea of these homeless veterans coming together to exchange their stories, and the older vet ends up being a vet of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about his own displacement. Mm-hmm. And our protagonist is still dealing with the fact that 8 years after Vietnam, he doesn't have a literal or a figurative home anywhere. And again, that's something else that could be played out today. Oh. That world still exists, doesn't
okay,
it?
Okay, now you remind me something. You know, what I notice also as a virtue in African-American community where it's not disturbed by the power of, you know, white supremacy. If you go to let's say North Carolina, you have a whole family of black folks. When you go into that, what they do is they never undermine your pain, but they always try to collectivize it by giving it a historical perspective. In other words, the historical experience of black people does not allow one to be indulgent, even in his or her pain, above everything. What they do is, in doing that, they therapeutize each other, they exorcise each other. The whole thing, when you look at it, the whole idea of when does an older person transaction ideas with a younger person? When does the grandmother's truth seeps into the grandson? When is he ripe to hear? And I was using this whole thing, the jazz musician called ripe moment. When is the ripe moment for him to transaction his grandmother's history of resistance, the genomic history that is very important for him to go forward? Or would he give into the self-destructive mode of all of us, all our capacity for being denied to do a certain thing? So in other words, nursing pain, the community collectivizes it in a very amazing way. The church, the community, they try to nationalize it, saying, it's all our pain, my son. And now, where do you go from here?
Well, we go from here, we have to take a break. My guest is the award-winning filmmaker, Holly Jerima. His terrific film, which is now being re-released, playing in several cities around the country, but available on Netflix. The film is Ashes and Embers. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
The podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back. I'm flying from memory talking about the film Ashes and Embers, the 1984 film with its writer-director, the film professor and award-winning filmmaker, Holly Jerima. I think, again, because this film has such an impact on me when I saw it, I want you to tell the audience a little bit about what it's about. I mean, it really is kind of following an emotional and physical journey by a young man who's looking to find a dream, to find a place for himself. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I said it reminds me of The Three Sisters, getting the idea of looking for Moscow, a Moscow that they never get to.
Well, let me tell you now, the triangular forces are the, for example, the study group. These are left-wing folks who are real also and genuine, but do they know how to transaction with an ordinary black person? That's the test of them. Here they're talking about Vietnam, but Vietnam is in the room. And at no time did it occur to them that they should really hear him. And this is part of it. Then there's the grandmother and the TV repairman who are concerned about him.
Who are elders, who are elders, both a literal parent figure and a figurative parent figure.
Yes, yes. And they are very much in his life doing their best, struggling to get him out of his individualistic nursing of his Vietnam experience. And so it goes back to the whole idea of the fact that here he comes back from Vietnam. Initially, he even debates the rightness of that, but gradually, even in his subconscious, in his mind, he was the Vietnamese, which is what African Americans said anyway. For me, it's just cinematized it by cutting the newsreels of the abuse of Vietnamese people. It comes to haunt him to a point where I cut for the kicking of a Vietnamese to return into kicking him visually and falling in the streets of Washington, D.C. And then I have the land where the grandmother, the land where
the
he
home.
Shot it, yeah, at home, where his umbilical cord is, and then the dreamland of Hollywood, we shot it like hazy. Here again is Hollywood. He wants to be an actor, but his friend is him and just wait by the telephone to for whatever Hollywood is to call them. And would they be wasted like this? Or the elders' advice, could it therapeutically come to cure him? In the sense that it is after leaving all the caring of these elders and running away from them, he comes to Hollywood, he's paired with another dreamer. It's there he works out to returning to the sources. And this all, again, is really what Cabral would say, return to the sources. Therapeutically, he goes back to get his healing because they did have, they're saying, we valued your pain, but come and enter the streamlines of the legacy of struggle. Black people's life in this country is a life of struggle.
And as you're talking about the building blocks of the film, you're talking about Big Ben, and there's a, what I remember, a heartbreaking sequence where Randolph is told, we're looking for an actor who's no Shakespeare, who can do accents, all these things that sound perfect for him. And then his friend pulls the rug out from him. Oh, by the way, it says only people with blonde hair and blue eyes can apply for this role. This could be Oscar so white. Again, this is something else about
oh, my
the entertainment
goodness.
That hasn't changed.
Yeah, the very vocabulary. You know, my brother, Hollywood, you know, so-called, now it's phantom Hollywood, but Hollywood, at it genomically, you know, start to evolve, it created prototype, the sexual attractive, the ugly, the demon, the African who is the savage, the Native American who is the savage, the heroes. People do not know. If you study the contemporary white actors, men and women, they are genetically prototypes of the early stars, the legacy of stars that Hollywood fabricated. And black people have to compete with this 100 years vocabulary of white supremacy. And one place that nobody demonstrated against is Hollywood, because they're liberals. Even when you think of it, the civil rights movement paid attention to the symptoms of racism, if I may say so. The cause of racism is the cultural, you know, the cultural colonialism of both white and black people by the culture of this white supremacist industry that says beauty is this. It creates the handsome of the attractive. In fact, black people have to dilute to really qualify the sexual attractive. Otherwise, they will be always the exotic. Because from day one, Hollywood put black women and black men as the exotic sidekicks. And it plagues all the way to Morgan Freeman is in a movie. He is in a woman is trying to be a boxer. Eastman is there. And next thing you know, you say, where is this black guy coming? Where is he going? Why is he orphaned? Why doesn't he have a beginning and end? And then you go to Casablanca. You say, when I was a student, this was the fight in the school at UCLA. Casablanca makes white people cry. White students cry. The professors cry. And we're saying, but this Sammy guy, why is he carrying a piano all the way to Paris and Africa to accompany white love story? This is really unbelievable. The whole proposition to say he goes to Africa and he doesn't have no common sense to get even an African girlfriend to have his own life going. But even Nick, I think the Bogart character, is revolutionary. Towards the end, he does amazing thing, even sacrificing love. But what is that black man doing? Even Bogart says he, you know, He said, an Arab guy comes to buy Sammy. Say, let me buy him. So the whole idea of saying, the story we know, every black American that returned to Africa, married a local, created a local society, a local contradictions. They don't just go following a white man and say, you live for me, I have nothing to live for. This continues to come in a very modern, spectacle, digital way. I've seen Mr. Morgan, I've seen him in three films. One with Robert Redford as an orphan. No origin, no love life, no. All the white characters have something to live for. The black guy vicariously lives for the white man and claims he lived a life. And this is not acceptable. And then I was on the plane watching a film with, again, Mr. Morgan, with married to a white woman. It's a good story, and I wish they had a kid, but they don't have a kid. It's a reason why maybe they don't have a kid in the plot. But then their kid is a dog, and I said to myself, I've never seen him in a movie with a black woman like this. A nice love story with Diane Keaton. I said, this is America's mindset in the vocabulary of what the industry has developed. And so both good white people and good black people would always be victims of this arrangement that says black people are not their own self-agency to be human.
My guest was just giving us a whole new definition of the phrase, play it, Sam, from Casablanca. It's Holly Jerima. The film he's talking about is Ashes and Embers, but he's done a number of great films, including Sankofa, which is when I first met him over 20 years ago. And again, what I want to get back to, and for me, these three films between Bush Mama and Ashes and Embers and Sankofa are about people of color who have one expectation. They almost know better than to have that expectation. I mean, our hero in Bushman thinks he's coming home to be saluted for his service. The protagonist of Ashes and Embers thinks that by sheer virtue of having talent, he will succeed. And the woman in Sankofa believes that by sheer virtue of her talent, which is her beauty, she will succeed as well. And this idea of having to play out in the most painful terms possible that sheer talent is not agency is something that we are reminded of time and time again. And it's always shocked me that these films of yours, because of what you do with them, don't have more mainstream impact. And that's, I do wonder if that infuriates you in some way.
No, my brother, it doesn't. You know what infuriates me is the black bourgeoisie here in Africa and Brazil and the
Caribbean.
And
that's also the black bourgeoisie you talked about in Ashes and Embers. It's talked about.
My brother, you see, if for me, you know, you see, black capitalism is primitive accumulation based, not cultural based. White capitalism is culture based. That's why it moves in a very, the genealogy of white capitalism is amazing, but it's culturally held. The spinal cord of white capitalism is really white, you know,
there's a politic that's invented that sort of explains
it.
From Marxism to free enterprise.
Yeah. Absolutely. But black folks, you know, with their money, they do not understand if they bring into the picture the idea of business, film business, distribution, exhibition, taking people like, I'm willing to work for a black producer, I will not submit to a white person telling me what story to tell because it will not be even good to that white person to be in that position over me.
But you must have had meetings after Sankofa, which has some success and which is written about. You must have had people out here in Los Angeles talk to you about making films. That there must have been some conversation, some entertainment, the idea you're doing stuff, mustn't there?
Well, I'll tell you. See, initially, I had gone few places, including American Playhouse, with this script, Sankofa, for example. But we were always rejected by PBS, CPB, etc. Even a black empowered folks have rejected us.
Because
they would say, at one point, American Playhouse said, too many characters. At one point, they said, in their writing, too many African-named people. It doesn't look like it's an American story. Little do they know that Africans have brought with them even jazz music is what they brought from Africa, what they synthesized in America. So, my brother, it's a surreal situation. But I'll tell you, I did not expect, you know, because even the independent white community in their magazines, you don't see them dealing with Sankofa when it hit the Berlin Film Festival. You know why? Because they could not accept the not only the structure, the narrative, but the arrogance of making a feature film without their involvement is not a hard thing for them to take. In fact, let me tell you, at that time, what you don't know is when we opened in Marina del Rey, sold out, the vice president of United Artists, I think, was the distribution company.
It was the United Artists Theater.
Yeah, they evicted us with police cars and trucks. Sankofa was evicted out of the theater.
Why was it evicted?
Well, let me tell you. When the day before he evicted me, he called me, and the director distribution sister with me, working with me, was on the line. Three of us on the line with the vice president, and he says, "I'm terminating you." And I said, "Why?" He says, "The Sankofa tension." I said, "What has that got to do with the price of tea in China?" I said to him. And he says, "Don't play with me. I said, "Listen, excuse me, sir. Why are you terminating? My manager checked into a hospital." I said, "What has that got to do with anything?" He says, "Well, the Sankofa pressure." put my manager to a hospital. This is on record, my brother. Nobody would believe it. No sane person could imagine this thing. The Sankofa pressure, I said, is there a Die Hard pressure? Because Die Hard is playing next door, as crowded as ours. Okay? This is what people do not believe. I'm telling you, from the managers, the sabotage of putting black material to filter our film to look bad. I'm telling you, the experience, one day I'll send you what I'm writing. Because to me, fair capitalism, you know, here we are in the theater, 50% for us, 50% for them. We don't have we sell popcorn, Coke for them. They don't help us advertise. Footwork, word of mouth, and they were sharing 50% of our profit and still evicted us when we were doing at the height of our business. It's later on we came back when Magic Johnson Sony Theater. The community literally was up in arms. Many things were about to happen in that period. And so the thing about it, it's not even fair. When white Americans do not control, when they're not in charge, for example, Sankofa, we always said we made it ourselves. Black people would roar from Baltimore to Ohio to Florida. When we tell them first, we produced it, they cannot. Because you can, you know, white folks could do a film on slavery and still can mortgage mentally black people for being eternally grateful. There's a dangerous things in game there. My wife and me said, we're going to produce it. We will not allow white people to be in charge of the making of a film on slavery. Not because we hated white people, not because we're racist. It's just the arrangement is dangerous because iconically what is red is really the white person. In a film on slavery, they remember the white actors, not necessarily many times the black actors. Why? Because there is this trust fund of whiteness that could even sometimes go to a bank to get loan. So for me, it was very important that I understood there was no future for me there, number one. Number two, I'll tell you this. One guy came to me, in fact, and proposed to take over the film. $50 million, I'll get you. You're distributing it wrong, which he was right. It was at Magic Johnson Theater. And he said, let me take it over. Give it to me. Let me make you a millionaire. $50 million, I guarantee you. I said, this is something that other black filmmakers have to hear. I called Charles Burnett and a few others, and I said to him, well, I have partners. You need to come say what you said in front of my friends. Because no one would believe me what he said. There's another thing he said, I'm going to bring it now. Charles Burnett, all my friends are there. I said, well, they're my partners. Propose your proposal. He says, not only that, he says, I will make the black congressman endorse your film on the steps of the Capitol. Okay? And $50 million and above. This film has so much. And he's right. If we had given it to them in their marketing approach, etc., the film could go for. But the idea that black people made a film on slavery itself is part of what we have. We are the self-agency should never be preempted. Otherwise, my own children, you know, my son now who wants to be a filmmaker, it's very important he knew his mother and me put together a movie. However humble, however imperfect, we put a film together. Black kids should know that we put a system together and it can go. The self-agency is where we shortchange black kids who go to school. When we tell them, you have no role in the history of your liberation. That's like the most violent, silent, genocidal thing you could do to Native American kids, to black kids, and then expect a peaceful planet is beyond me. And so I have rudely studied this system very well. After I showed, I brought Charles Burnett to hear this proposal, I told the brother, the guy, he said, I'm not at this point ready to give you the film. I just want him to hear, because when I talk like this, I want people to be there witnessing how he thought about he'd bring all the black congressmen on the steps of the Capitol. They were coming to my films hiding at night, even when the Washington Post editorial says every congressman should go see Sankofa. Some were coming at night hiding.
I don't know how to say this, except to say we're out of time. You have to come back. I'm going to say it again. Your film, which is receiving a re-release now, thanks to the company Array, Ava DuVernay's company, the film is Ashes and Embers. I cannot suggest that people see it strongly enough. It's available on Netflix. It's playing around the country. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you, my brother.
Well, let me thank a few people. I'm starting with Leo Delagula, who is the recording engineer at NPR West. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Pite, who's associate producer. I've learned a lot here today. It's The Treatment. catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.